Bats are often misunderstood and feared creatures, but they play a vital role in ecosystems around the world. From pollinating plants to controlling insect populations, these fascinating mammals deserve our appreciation and protection. Welcome back to Rewildology, the nature podcast that explores the human side of conservation, travel, and rewilding the planet. I'm your host, Brooke Mitchell, conservation biologist and adventure traveler. April 17th is Bat Appreciation Day, and to celebrate, we're releasing this special mini-sode to share with you Iroro Tanshi's incredible story about rediscovering the short-tailed round-leaf bat in her home country of Nigeria. We rarely have the opportunity to find a lost species, and sometimes magical moments like this one come to us. If you'd like to hear Iroro's full story, including her journey into bat research, engaging local communities in bat conservation, launching her NGO, Small Mammal Conservation Organization, and lots of laughs, scroll through the archives and check out episode 36. Don't forget to submit your photos for Rewildology's 2024 Earth Day contest. Our theme this year is thriving freshwater and marine ecosystems. To learn more about the contest and to submit your photos, check out the link in this episode's description or head on over to the website and click on the photo contest page under the resources tab. All right, everyone, please enjoy this short and sweet Bat-tastic mini-sode with Iroro. So then how did your work in Nigeria start then? Like, what was the question that even led you back there? Because it sounds like you were really in depth on these other countries and studying bats in other places of the world. So what brought you back to your home country? And like, what was the question you asked? And of course, this might be a good introduction to how you found the short-tailed round-leaf bat. So yeah, how did all of that come to be?
Okay. I really like that question because I haven't thought about it that way where, you know, it's like you're going to these different countries and doing bat stuff or getting inspired by work from other countries. But so I'd already mentioned that there's very limited expertise, right? And to a certain extent, I've been quite passionate about helping to improve the capacity in country and, you know, just evidence, like basic scientific evidence for, you know, general ecology and of course, bat ecology. So it wasn't even a question of whether I wanted to study or do my PhD in Nigeria. It was a question of what type of exciting question will it be, you know? So in fact, that was in my original plan. Like I told my professor, I wanted to, so this is why I was looking for a professor who would work in the old world, right? I wanted to do my work in Nigeria. And that's kind of what she, you know, supports anyway. You know, she gets all these international students who want to go back home to do their field work. And, you know, so that's kind of that about going back home. But about the questions that then led me to discovering these bats for the first time in Nigeria. So I started off trying to do like a cave project. Because, you know, again, you know, climbing trees, crawling in caves, doing all this stuff. But the types of questions that I was interested in really needed a lot of caves across lots of habitats or like a really broad geographical extent. In my case, this is the other part of the story, right? I also wanted to work in southeastern Nigeria on the border with Cameroon. Like, I've been quite specific in the number of things I wanted to do. Like, it's bats, it's Nigeria, it's southeastern Nigeria.
This, you know, spot.
So, because, you know, they've got the best forest in Nigeria. Like, that's the only place where you find primary forest, like untouched forest left, you know, in Nigeria. And they're also quite, the local people are also quite sympathetic to conservation work in general, because there are a lot of, it has the highest concentration of NGOs working on conservation for any part of the country, you know.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was like, this is heaven, this is Mecca. It's and it's a biodiversity hot spot, oh my gosh, for bats. And I just, again, automatic, it was like an automatic decision, you know. So, but the only snag there was my cave interest wasn't quite fitting in. So when we visited in 2014, December into January 2015, my friends actually came out with me and we sort of started trying to find caves. First of all, no one's done a cave project in the area, whether for bats or for any other taxa. So they're fairly undocumented, so to speak. So you've got to find local people who know where the caves are and try to find those caves. And some of these caves were like a whole day apart. There was no way I was going to be able to really manage like a full scale project looking at caves for the types of questions that I was interested in too. So I ended up just saying, you know, my professor and I were just sat down thinking about what to do. And we were looking at this beautiful mountain landscape. And she was like, why don't you look at elevational gradients? I was like, yeah, that sounds fun. Because, you know, again, it meant I will be mountaineering and, you know, just climbing all of these fun places and going to top of ridges and whatnot. So so that's kind of where that set up from. So I sort of looked at the literature. There was a lot of cool stuff to be done, especially in the old world. So that's where it all came from. So my project became an ecological question about what bat communities are in the lowlands versus the highlands, you know, like, and how does that change as you go up? What are the processes driving that? And, you know, mechanistic, stochastic, you know, that sort of questions, set of questions in community ecology. But then before I went out, I needed to know what species to expect. Mind you, starting 2013, I was already pulling together after an internship at the Harrison Institute in the UK. I was already pulling together I already had it at the time, a database of bats known from Nigeria. So every bat ever collected and reported in the literature or in museums, I had it on the database. So I kind of knew what bats we had. And I was already working on that. Internship gave rise to a Bats of Nigeria project that we're already working on. So I kind of knew what bats we had and what we didn't have that you could expect to find on either side. So where Nigeria was a gap, so to speak. So I made a list of bats that I could potentially find at my field site, but on the basis of it being known from either sides of Nigeria or it being known on the border with Cameroon. Because Cameroon has received quite a bit more research for bats versus Nigeria. But we share this exciting biodiversity hotspot, you know. So it's almost, you know, intuitive to kind of expect that what you find across the border, you find on this side.
Absolutely, because they don't know country lines.
Exactly. So I kind of, you know, had a list that I was looking out for stuff. But, you know, a number of these bats that I even had didn't really have a photograph out there. So you weren't sure what it was. So you were just looking out for characteristics. It was like, oh, this one has got unusually large ears. Okay. That's enough for me. You know, and then this one's got, right, this one's really fluffy and just slightly bigger than this other one. So that's kind of how I kept a mental note of what to expect. And so on the ninth, we were collecting bats and I pulled out this one bat because, you know, you trap bats and then you go to the trap, you pick up the bat and put it in the bag and move it to your processing station. And so when I opened the bag and took out the bat, I was like, whoa, what are you? Because it has these really big ears. Yes. It's like unusually large ears. And it has like a button for a nose. It's like the middle of the nose is slightly flattened. And so it's like Yes. Roundish boxes. Like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. So I think I may have said a lot of things that night to my crew, like, you have no idea what this means. This is a bat that hasn't been caught in like 45 years. This is just, I was just literally talking to myself and just being so completely carried away. And
oh wow,
I think they let me get on with it. Like they were like, don't interrupt her. Let her just, because I was sounding a bit crazy, I think.
Let her get it out.
Because I was really excited. You know, and so that was quite something to have seen that species at that time. Yeah. But of course, 10 days later, we were running away from fire.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about that. So like you had this euphoria moment. You're like, oh my gosh, here is this bat that had, like you said, that hasn't been seen in 45 years. It is in my hand. Oh my God, this is history. Literally, we're making history right now. Yes. Then what happened 10 days later? What realization came at that moment?
Right. So at the time we collected, the first individual we collected that I was basically going crazy about was in the lowlands. And so we'd spent maybe 4 days at the site. I think it must have been on the third day we caught that individual. So by the fourth day we were done and we started moving up to the next point on the elevation. So basically what I was doing with my project was I start off at the bottom, 4 or 5 days of trapping, and then I moved to the next stratum, which would be about maybe 300 meters elevation, you know, difference from where it was coming from, or 250-ish. So at this point, I was already now in the mountains at about 400 meters elevation. And for a mountain that's steep, it's got some gentle sections, but it's quite a steep mountain. It's not an easy thing to navigate, okay? Especially at night. We're just lucky to have like a small table land somewhere where we could set up our camp and then set up traps. So we were just out trapping. It must have been the second and third day, and it was unusually windy and hot at the same time. Usually it's quite cool in the forest because, you know, it's foresty. A lot of the light's shaded out and a lot of the moisture has been trapped and kept kind of in place. So it's not cool, cold. It's like cool. It's like nice. It's not hot, hot. It's not very bad. So this was, it felt like hot air and it was windy. We could tell it was windy because the canopy, the leaves were moving a lot. But then just about when darkness hit, we started seeing from a distance that, you know, there was a ring, there was a line of fire. And it felt like it was moving towards us. I was like, oh, we have to move.
Oh God.
Anything can happen in a forest, especially in a mountain. It could move in one direction and then find you and just trap you in the forest. I could not even think of an alternative at the point, which was, you know, well, the only option was let's get out of here and just save our lives, basically. But also we had a volunteer at the time who was asthmatic. And so I was like, we have to get her out, you know? So we quickly got to camp, closed the traps, got to camp, protected. So we kind of protected all of our food and stuff by just getting them together, covering them with blankets, wet the blankets in case the fire came through the camp. And then we took all of our equipment that could not be replaced in country. And it was quite a bit because everybody had something on their back that was quite heavy, and in fact someone had to carry something on their head. It was quite it was a mad rush to protect and save ourselves at the same time, so we kind of just made a run for it. And by the time we got to the village, it was almost, it must have been 1 o'clock or at least definitely past midnight at this point by the time we were setting up tents in the village to sleep that night, because we couldn't go into people's houses. It was just not fair, you know, to go bothering people at that time. And, you know, we hadn't realized that fire was a problem in this place, or at least as bad of a problem. So that night we got into the village, the nearest house. We just pitched our tent right behind in the backyard, like, because, you know, there's no fencing. So we just got in, camped there, and just sort of try to be grateful that we were able to escape, so to speak. Yeah. So that was within a space of less than 2 weeks. We went from, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like, we're so privileged, so happy, so just excited that we're, you know, in the field and finding the species. And then oops, fire will destroy its habitat, you know? So I can't even begin to describe all of the emotions I felt. I think I went from being disappointed that, you know, we were going to lose a species habitat, because you wouldn't even know how extensive the fire would get. At this point, it had gotten out of hand. It had gotten beyond the level where local people could potentially stop it. Okay, so it was basically, there was a big trail up the, of like a big line, long line up the mountain of just fire proceeding through the forest. You know, so I was quite terrified. But then, as you can imagine, I was also quite terrified that this is it. I no longer have a PhD project, you know, like, because again, this is the reason why I wanted to be at this site, right? To be in undisturbed forest. But luckily it stopped just about 200 meters of that camp that we had escaped from, because there was
That's
a stream.
So close.
I know.
Oh my gosh.
There was a stream coming down the mountain. And so that, I know. But it didn't stop immediately, because, you know, we went into the village, tried to talk to people. They were like, no one's going to care about fighting fires. The government has tried, and a few other NGOs have tried, you know, like, just don't even bother. You know? So, well, we had to leave, first of all, to confer with my advisor and say, look, this is terrible. I don't know what to do. Talk to me, you know. Give me hope. Because I really did lose hope, I have to say. But I think we found a way around it.
Man.
Yeah.
Man, you're just like taking me through that emotional roller coaster. I can't even. No, don't apologize. No, I'm just like putting myself in your shoes, and I just can't even. Can't even fathom like what that had to have felt like. Well, one, literal fear for your life. And then two, like, oh my gosh, my academic career could be toast. And then three, what about this species that I just found? What's going to happen to them and the rest of them? Oh my gosh. I would have drank a lot that night. Goodness.
and it's such an interesting species in the sense that it's like, do not even disturb. It's like it needed, you know, how you go into a hotel and you say, do not disturb. Put that sign up on your door, or, you know, even at home, and you just say, do not, this is the species, this is that species that says, do not disturb, you know? So I was just running through all the motions of, what are we going to do? If you say everybody else has tried to, you know, stop fires in the past, and you're saying we can't do anything about it, you're just taking away all of the potential for stuff. You've taken away all the hope. Or anyway, so it was quite an interesting and terrifying period, I have to say.
So then what was the next step? So I'm assuming like an action plan was made. So what did you do next to either combat this issue or find a way around it? Or did you move sites? So what did you do?
Well, I did move sites. So I spoke with my advisor, and she was like, well, let's confer in a couple of days after you know, the condition of the fire. Did it stop? Like, how far did it get? Blah, blah, blah. So we kind of conferred, and, you know, after we didn't go to investigate. I think I was really mad at the community people at this time. I was quite upset with them. So we didn't go back into the forest to see the extent, but our partners who had sort of looked through to see how far it got came back and said, hey, it stopped short of your camp, and sort of told us how bad it was. But what I just meant was that camp was toast. There was no way we're going to keep working there. So we had to move, like, head more southwest where it was still good forest at that elevation, and, you know, carried on surveying. But at this time, the field season was already, like, kind of not really coming to an end, but I had run out of cash. Okay, so this is the really, I don't know if this it's the same thing with other people doing work in the field. Because of the uncertainties of, you know, transportation and, you know, getting people to work with you, like local assistants and all that, because I usually have a big team, okay? You make a budget for one thing, and then you get into the field, money just disappears. Okay? You know, it's like, what are we going to do? But the other thing is also, I think this was the second day of trapping at this site. And for you to make that journey to that site, it cost a lot of money. Okay. Mm. So I paid porters and, you know, field assistants to come work with us, and we had to evacuate and not able to use that site. So that site was just basically had gulped a lot of money and just went to ashes, more or less. And at this time, I was really quite broke already. So we had to call it and go recover, go try to raise more funds and come back the next year. So yeah, that was the intervention that was the next line of action we took for the PhD part of the work. But I think there's something about just knowing that, okay, if you say everybody else has tried and there's nothing we can do, how about we sit down and take stock of what people have done and see if there are gaps in what they did. Mm. And maybe we can then start to think, oh, maybe there's a solution here or there. That's kind of the approach we took. so we started having meetings, you know, small group meetings, but also a town hall meeting to say, guys, something has to happen, you know. And it's funny because when we were having some of the more individual or small gathering meetings, people would say, oh, no one's going to care. No one's interested in fire. You know, it even burns their farms. They're not interested in stopping it. But during the town hall meeting, like, people came with raw emotions. They were like, my farm got burnt 2 years ago. Like, oh, my entire life was gone in an instant. You know, like, people were so mad. In fact, we got to it about someone who died of a broken heart just because all of his life work was gone because fires had come through. So these fires will originate from farms where people, during just before the planting season, would try to take out the brush. And so for farmers who are not, you know, careful, this can then become a wildfire that goes to other people's farms, but of course also the forest. You know, so the local people were already just sick of it. You know, like, so even though a couple of people have said this wasn't possible, we played this stuff here and there, a good number of people were like, let's do something, and I'm happy this is happening. Let's come together and make it work, you know. So that was really encouraging, because that just meant, okay, now we can, you know, talk to people and make it work. And yeah. So that was also the year we decided to launch our NGO, because there were two other things we'd noticed. Well, at least one other thing we noticed, you know how I said this area, this is Bokiland, Afi Mountain Wildlife Sanctuary, Koshiba National Park, Bay Mountains, that it had the highest number of NGOs, or at least conservationists working in the area. Most of these, in fact, all of his work had been on iconic megafauna, you know, like gorillas, elephants, and drill monkeys and whatnot. Now, that's good. And those have been, you know, they've been umbrella species in their own right. But here's the thing. So local people would say, do not touch a gorilla, do not touch an elephant, because, you know, so-and-so, government's going to come after you, so-and-so is going to come after you, but then take everything else. We were like, this has to stop. Like, we have to let people know, if it's a conservation area, if it's a national park where you can't take anything out, then you can't take anything out. Like, it's meant for all species, it's not just for gorillas or elephants. So that's kind of where the name small mammal conservation came out of. It's like, not so much how mammalogists would think of small mammals being just rodents. It was more like small sized mammals matter too. You know, it's like small sized mammals are important too. It's not just the megafauna, guys. You know, so that's kind of, it was all these different things, even though so our plan that the NGO should sort of be launched after our PhDs is like, you know, go focus on your PhDs, finish that first. But with this problem, it was obvious. It was like, there's no way around this. We can't wait another 5 years before we start this journey. This bad attention, you know, so.
Wow. So all this is happening, like, all culminating at the exact same time. So you're like coming up with new funding to start a new, essentially all over again. And then you also launch an NGO at the same time. Wow.
I know.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you for joining me on this wild adventure today. I hope you've been inspired by the incredible stories, insights, and knowledge shared in this episode. To learn more about what you heard, be sure to check out the show notes at rewildology.com. If you enjoyed today's conversation and want to stay connected with the Rewildology community, hit that subscribe button and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast app. I read every comment left across the show's platforms, and your feedback truly does mean the world to me. Also, please follow the show on your favorite social media app, join the Rewildologist Facebook group, and sign up for the weekly Rewildology newsletter. In the newsletter, I share recent episodes, the latest conservation news, opportunities from across the field, and updates from past guests. If you're feeling inspired and would like to make a financial contribution to the show, head on over to rewildology.com and donate directly to the show through PayPal, or purchase a piece of swag to show off your Rewildology love. Remember, rewilding isn't just a concept, it's a call to action. Whether it's supporting a local conservation project, reducing your own impact, or simply sharing the knowledge you've gained today, you have the power to make a difference. A big thank you to the guests that come onto the show and share their knowledge with all of us, and to all of you Rewildology listeners for making the show everything it is today. This is Brooke signing off. Remember, together we will rewild the planet.